This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Each year, the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center sponsors an events series organized around a topic of interest and consequence to the UC Santa Barbara community. This year's series, called Fallout in the Aftermath of War, has brought to campus scholars, journalists, and artists to explore the far-ranging impact of the recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The final event of the Fallout series is tonight's debate, Drone Warfare, Prospects, and Perils, which will focus on the most sustained controversy to emerge from the recent wars. Intensifying the controversy, just last week, the Pakistani High Court issued a ruling that drone strikes are absolutely illegal and a blatant violation of sovereignty of the state of Pakistan. The court decision also indicated that because these strikes have killed innocent people, they must be declared a war crime. In one sense, the question of drone deployment was already a key issue in the war on terror before it openly began. For by the summer of 2001, in the Nevada desert, a Predator drone had successfully destroyed a mock-up of Osama bin Laden's Afghanistan residence. And 1 week before the 9/11 attacks, at a White House meeting, administration officials had discussed such a mission. But they could not agree on who should carry it out, the CIA or the Pentagon, or whether the missiles would be sufficiently lethal. So the mission was not authorized. Within days after 9/11, the CIA had launched armed drones. And as their deployment in Afghanistan and Iraq increased, drones came to assume great symbolic meaning in the American imagination. As Professor Daniel Rothenberg has written, drones captivate us. Their sleekly disturbing look is an odd combination of the fragile and the deadly. The word drone highlights these qualities, depicting a machine that is solitary, potentially autonomous, ever-present, and quietly menacing. Watching the new Tom Cruise film, Oblivion, I was struck by the way drones are portrayed as both fascinating and fearsome. They appear to be the hero's weapon of defense, but the reality is otherwise. They are, in fact, the lethal agents of hostile aliens intent on manipulating and controlling the post-nuclear world depicted in the film. It may well be that the film's portrayal of drones is tapping into the American public's anxiety over the possibility that drones will be used as invasive tools of state surveillance or as weapons for attacking and killing U.S. citizens on American soil. It is beyond question that drones are here to stay. But the manifold questions that arise concerning the appropriateness, legitimacy, and potential illegality of drone strikes are far from resolved. Tonight, we will hear those issues discussed by legal and political scholars who are highly knowledgeable about such questions and whom it is my privilege now to introduce to you. David Cole is professor at Georgetown University Law Center and an expert on national security, constitutional law, and criminal justice. He is an award-winning author whose articles and commentaries have appeared in both legal journals and in the popular press, such as The Nation, Legal Times, and The New York Times. Mary Ellen O'Connell is a chaired professor of law and a research professor at the University of Notre Dame. A widely published scholar of international law, legal theory, and dispute resolution, in addition to her academic career, Professor O'Connell was an attorney at an international law firm, and she was also a professional military educator in Germany for the U.S. Department of Defense. Avery Plaugh earned his doctoral degree in political science from McGill University and since 2006 has been teaching political science at University of Massachusetts Dartmouth. Professor Plaus fields of specialization include political theory and international relations, and he has published essays and books on a variety of topics, including the legality, politics, and ethics of targeting terrorists. Our moderator for tonight's discussion is Jeff Greenfield, who has been a significant presence in American media for over 30 years. He served as media commentator for CBS and as political and media analyst for ABC News, only two of the many positions Jeff Greenfield has held. He has written for countless publications and has authored or co-authored a dozen books, the newest of which, If JFK Lived, will be published in October. So please help me welcome our speakers and Jeff Greenfield, who will now open tonight's debate.
Welcome. Good to see you all. I learned, because of my fading memory, that I was actually a participant in the very first group debate 12 years ago with Bill Sapphire and Kathleen Hall Jamison. So based on that track record, I will see you again in 2025. Let me just set the scene. Let me just first tell you how we're going to do this. Each of the participants will speak for 5 minutes. We will then engage each other in a free-flowing conversation. The last 20 minutes will be devoted to questions from the audience. There are microphones on either side. Let me just implore you, beg you, in the interest of massive participation, that we have a common understanding of what a question is. I should also warn you that, unlike my distinguished academic compatriots here, I come from the news business. I have no tact. So that is the format. I'll just tell you, set the scene with one observation, and then we'll begin. September 2000, predator drones, unarmed predator drones, put into service in Afghanistan and the region by Richard Clark, the counterterrorism chief, and Coffer Black from the CIA. One of the predator drones near Kandahar spots a tall, distinctive-looking fellow who they are sure is Osama bin Laden. And the drone follows Osama bin Laden and his compatriots for quite some time. 2 years prior, President Clinton had signed notifications authorizing the killing of bin Laden. But every time he was spotted, the only way to get to him was with cruise missiles, which were hundreds of miles and several hours away. And the question was, can you guarantee that bin Laden will be there? And the answer was always no, so nothing was done. The similar thing happened that very time. So as a writer of alternate history, I sometimes wonder if the predator drones following Osama bin Laden had been armed with Hellfire missiles then, a year before 9/11, how might history would it have been different, and would we have thought any differently about the use of predator drones? With that observation, let's begin. Avery Plaw, floor is yours.
Let me start by thanking you, the Roop debate, the IHC, for inviting me here. I love California, and I love a good debate, and this is a very important topic for us to be addressing today, so I'm really delighted to be here with you. But I should perhaps express a note of caution to start, and not only because I find myself up here arguing with two very esteemed lawyers, and I am not one, but more importantly, I fear that the panel today does not fully represent the range of U.S. views on the subject. Perhaps there's no way that it possibly could. The latest polling numbers that I've seen, that is the New York Times CBS News poll at the end of last month, showed 70% of Americans approving drone strikes abroad and only 20% opposing. Now, Mary Ellen and David are both outspoken critics of the drone program. And while I do agree with most Americans in approving the use of drones, at least against key leadership targets and experts like bomb makers, I've also been critical of the broadened use of the drone program over the last 5 years, especially in regards of signature strikes and the deliberate targeting of low-level militants. So I'm not sure that the current Obama policy, however popular it may be with most Americans, will get the vigorous defense that would produce a full and balanced examination of the topic. But still, I will advance a firm defense of drone strikes against specifically key leadership targets and experts on the following four grounds: their tactical effectiveness, their strategic impact, their ethics, and I'll even venture into the difficult area a little bit of legality. And we can perhaps talk in the question period also of what could be said in the spirit of debate about the broader program that President Obama has initiated. So first, drones are tactically effective. U.S. officials claim that over 20 of the top 30 al-Qaeda leadership targets have been killed by drones, in addition to many suspected militants of a lower-level status. And these claims, at least, have a good deal of independent support. In Pakistan, where the great majority of drone strikes have taken place, the four online databases that track drone strikes indicate that somewhere between 50 and 82 total high-value targets have been killed, along with somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 3,000 lower-level suspected militants. So that's quite a lot. Of course, there have also been civilian deaths, and estimates vary, but generally they fall within a range of 5% to 20% of the total deaths, which is, of course, terrible, as are, of course, the many thousands of deaths caused by al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Nonetheless, the numbers on the drone attacks in terms of civilian casualties do compare favorably with the alternative military tactics that have been used in the area, including the Pakistani army operations and U.S. commando raids, which tend to kill upwards of 30% of civilians. And in the case of the Pakistani army, for example, also displace thousands of people and tend to flatten villages. Indeed, the numbers connected with the drone strikes actually compare quite favorably with the overall estimates of civilian deaths in armed conflicts at the end of the 20th century generally. And this is in spite of the fact that the terrain is extremely remote and difficult, and the targets involved don't distinguish themselves from the civilian population, actually live within the civilian population. So it does seem, at least based on the best available evidence that we have, that the drones are quite precise. Finally, all four of the databases tracking the drone strikes show a very sharp decline in civilian casualties over the last 3 years in particular, falling under, if you average the reports of these databases, you get under 2% in the last year, civilian casualties. And so far this year, even the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, which is the most sensitive and is really focused on identifying every civilian casualty, has reported no clear cases of civilian casualties in the 12 strikes that have occurred so far this year. And that's actually reinforced by two of the three other databases. So you can make a strong case that drones are the most effective tactical weapon available to us. Second point, drone strikes support our strategic goals. There is very clear evidence that drones are having a devastating effect on terrorist groups that are targeted, especially in Pakistan, and particularly with regards to disrupting operations, training, and leadership attrition. The clearest evidence are bin Laden's own communications recovered from his Abbottabad compound. He writes, "Our Waziristani brothers are frankly exhausted from the enemy's bombardments." He complains that they cannot safely move recruits into the Fatah, the region of Pakistan where most of the drone strikes are taking place. He complains that the leadership is becoming inexperienced through attrition, leading to ineffective operations. And he actually contemplates abandoning this former safe haven area altogether because of the bombardments. So there is some strong evidence that they're having the desired effect. Third, limited drone use is ethically defensible. The main framework that we use to assess ethics in war, and which has provided the moral foundation for the contemporary law of war, is just war theory. And it provides the basis for a powerful case for limited drone use. For example, preventing terrorist atrocities fits very well into the requirement for a just cause. Preventing atrocities against civilians is by nature a just purpose. Drones also fit well with the requirement for proportionate force because they're so precise and discriminating. And also the U.S. policy, announced policy of always preferring arrest would fit very well with the requirement for last resort. So, for example, Michael Walzer, the the godfather of modern just war theorists, endorses the U.S. use of drone strikes against al-Qaeda and its affiliates with the same kind of reservations that I've expressed, that is, excluding signature strikes, and as long as they're done consistently with the principles of distinction and proportionality. Finally, fourth, there are at least some legal grounds for justifying the drone strike. So I'm going to wade here very briefly into this very vexed area. I believe that I heard Mary Ellen once say that non-experts should not talk about these legal questions because we just inevitably confuse things. But I hope for the purposes of debate she'll forgive me from wading in a little bit. I'm sure it will give her lots of matter to respond to. The U.S. believes itself to be in a non-international armed conflict with al-Qaeda and its affiliates, in which it is permitted to target enemy combatants, and that's what going after leadership targets and experts would be. The U.S. has also traditionally taken a very broad view of the right of self-defense, which would permit it to use military force in its own protection, including against non-state actors. It also claims to have been operating with the consent of the governments on whose territory it has carried out strikes. And this is pretty well established in Yemen and Somalia, and there's a good deal of evidence that it has been true in Pakistan as well, although recent decision of Parliament, the Supreme Court's decision that we just heard about, and the election of a new president, Mr. Sharif, who is not so favorable towards American involvement, may end that, at least the plausibility of a claim of consent going forward. But in the past, it seems there's been a good deal of evidence. In fact, until 2011, drone strikes were actually flown from bases in Pakistan, in Shamsi-Baluchistan mainly, which would seem to indicate the complicity of the Pakistani government. Now, all of these claims as legal claims are certainly contested, and perhaps rightly so. But I would suggest that developed and elaborated more clearly and defended more publicly, they can provide a plausible ground for at least a narrow targeting policy based on leaders and experts. Ultimately, however, I would end by suggesting that the defenders of the current drone policy and its critics are eventually going to have to come to some kind of consensual compromise agreement on a new reasonable set of rules to restrain the use of drones going forward, which is an inevitable element of our future. And that's what we should be focused on in regards to the legal questions. Thank you very much.
I'm going to pose one question to each of our debaters because I want to. In his new book, Day of the Knife, Michael Mazzetti writes this, because it goes to your point about civilian casualties. He says, as the death toll in Pakistan mounted, Obama officials at one point claimed the increased drone strikes in Pakistan had not led to any civilian deaths. It was something of a trick of logic, Mazzetti writes. In an area of known militant activity, all military-age males were considered to be enemy fighters. Therefore, anyone who was killed in a drone strike was categorized as a combatant. Isn't that a bit of an Orwellian use of language to justify these things?
I think it is an Orwellian use of language and was a very unfortunate position for Mr. Brennan to have taken. In the course of these remarks, I haven't used any statistics that have been provided by the U.S. government, but only independent databases that accumulate statistics on the strikes. Admittedly, there's a certain degree of uncertainty that arises because they're based on media sources and international reporters are not allowed to go to the FATA, the federally administrated tribal areas of Pakistan. So they draw on a variety of different sources, some local sources, but also intelligence officers within Pakistan and the United States, and sometimes the statements of the Taliban or al-Qaeda itself. So there's a degree of uncertainty that pervades the whole issue of the numbers. That's why I've tried to draw on a whole series of different sources. I think that Mr. Brennan's statement was misleading, and I think that it served to discredit the administration and its statements going forward because it's implausible on its face. I'm hoping that the administration seriously rethought its view and is willing to acknowledge that they can't assume that everybody is a combatant just because they're males of mature age. But they have to investigate and be accurate. And I think that the databases are very helpful for holding them to a degree of accountability.
All right, thanks. Next up, from Georgetown Law Center, David Cole.
Thank you. I, too, would like to thank the Roop Foundation for having us here and for all of you for coming out to discuss this topic. Avery began with the classic debater's tactic of talking about the difficulty of debating against one's opponents. We are eminent lawyers, or at least one of us is an eminent lawyer. I won't speak for myself. But he didn't talk about the difficulty of debating against a political scientist. And so I thought that I, too, should start with some statistics and some polling so that I can, you know, stand with the political scientists. So I found a poll that was reported on some time ago, a couple of months ago, and it's a report of a University of Minnesota poll which showed that 97% of those surveyed, quote, strongly agreed, quote, unquote, with the statement, "I personally do not want to be killed by a drone." 3% responded, "Don't know, no opinion." And when this poll was brought to the attention of the White House, their spokesperson, Jay Carney, was said to have responded, "Look, people are afraid of getting killed by a drone. We get that. But there is still broad public support for drones killing somebody else." And what I want to talk about is the somebody else. You know, one of the things that is striking to me is that around the world, the views of our drone policy are not that dissimilar from views of our torture policy under our previous president. I think those policies are very different. I think torture is something that is never acceptable. It is clearly proscribed by international law, including in times of war, whereas killing is not. Killing is an unfortunate but necessary part of war, and targeted killing is better than untargeted killing. Nonetheless, there is this sense around the world that the drones are Obama's Abu Ghraib, Obama's Guantanamo. Of course, Obama still has Guantanamo, but they are his. They are a problem of that magnitude, and they generate that kind of resentment. So, I guess the thing that I think we need to ask is why. What are the reasons that this tactic of killing, a presumptively legitimate thing to do during war, are viewed with such skepticism and resentment around the world? And I think there's four reasons, really. The first is the secrecy that surrounds this program. And I think this is, to me, the most problematic aspect of the drone program thus far is its secrecy. We don't know. What we do know is that the president has the power, exercises the power, to kill people without trial, without a hearing, without notice, in secret. The rules that govern that power, a pretty awesome power, and a power that has been exercised against U.S. citizens, are secret. We don't even know the terms under which the president is exercising this remarkable power. That, to me, is unacceptable in a democracy. Second, the power is exercised in an officially unacknowledged way. That is, we have not acknowledged that we have killed these 3,000-plus people who have been killed with drones. The killings are not acknowledged. They are themselves secret killings. So even if we knew about the rules, we wouldn't know about the actual events. The government doesn't take responsibility for its own actions, and that seems deeply problematic in a democracy. So first is this inordinate secrecy. Second, I think the drone policy is seen around the world, and rightly so, as reflecting American exceptionalism in the following sense. We would not accept a world in which other countries were deploying drones in the way that we are deploying drones. We would not accept a world in which Russia and China and North Korea and Iran asserted the power to kill their enemies in foreign countries by pushing a button in secret, in unacknowledged fashion, and the like. And so the fact that we do it in ways that we would not tolerate if others were doing it is reflects this attitude of exceptionalism that I think creates a tremendous amount of resentment about the United States. It's not my view that we should not be using drones, but we should be using drones in ways that are public, transparent, and that we would accept as legitimate if the rest of the world were engaging in the same sorts of practices. Third, drones make it too easy to kill. Some people say, oh, drones, it's not really that different from, you know, other technological developments of in warfare. Bows and arrows made it easier to kill. Catapults made it easier to kill. Guns made it easier to kill. Airplanes made it easier to kill. This is just another small step towards oblivion. But I don't think it's a small step. I think that there's something to me particular about the ability to push a button here and kill a single person anywhere on the globe that is in a very targeted way that is that raises very serious questions about how war should be carried out going forward, because what it does is it takes away all the practical and pragmatic disincentives to war. In the old days, if there was somebody in Yemen who we thought was dangerous and we wanted that person to be neutralized, we couldn't push a button and neutralize him. We'd have to send troops into Yemen, put boots on the ground, and that's not an easy thing to do. Or we'd have to drop a bomb on the place where the individual was, and that would have significant collateral damage, and that's not easy to do. We would not be able to engage in plausibly deniable military action, because military action was overt by its nature. We now have the ability to push buttons, engage in very targeted killings in deniable ways, and what that does, I think, is make it too easy to kill and make it too tempting for public officials to use military means to resolve problems rather than alternatives. And that brings me to my fourth concern, the fourth reason why I think the drone policy raises very serious questions, and that is, what does it do to the scope of war? What is the appropriate definition of the scope of war? Drones, we have used drones on battlefields, and I don't think anybody would say that it's impermissible to use a drone to kill the enemy on a battlefield, even in a signature strike. We don't have to identify by name the people we're fighting against when we're on a battlefield. We can shoot and kill them without getting their name and serial number. So targeted killing on battlefields, not controversial. But when you take this technology and deploy it in ways that permit us to kill thousands of miles from any battlefield, to kill people who are not part of the organization that attacked us on 9/11 and with which we are in a armed conflict authorized by Congress, then I think very serious questions are raised about what the scope of the war is. And in some ways, I think it raises the possibility, if we're going to continue to use drones to target our terrorist threats wherever they may be, and in places where we can't deal with them in some other way, it raises the very serious possibility that we have resurrected the concept of the war on terror that George Bush proclaimed and that President Obama rejected because of this temptation to deal with threats around the world, not through law enforcement, not through engagement, not through foreign policy, but instead by pushing a button and eliminating a human being's life. And I think that's a very, very dangerous road to go down. Thank you very much.
Let me turn your argument inside out with this question. Let's go back to 1990 and the invasion of Kuwait, not the Iraq War of 2003. Because we couldn't target Saddam Hussein, and assassination was off the table because it was terrible and immoral, we dropped God knows how many bombs, killed thousands upon thousands of retreating Iraqi soldiers. Nobody will know how many Iraqi civilians we killed. And it seems to me that the argument you make that it makes killing too easy ought to be looked at the other way. If the alternative to a targeted killing or an assassination is the death of thousands of innocents, why isn't that a better way? Why isn't it good to have that targeted killing?
Well, if that were the alternative, it would be better. And it is certainly better to have a targeted killing than an untargeted killing, to be able to engage in pinpoint accurate strikes versus more brutal measures that, as Avery suggested, have historically had much more collateral damage. But, of course, that's not the only alternative, right? And so it's not the only alternative because in many instances, one would not go to war if one could not use a drone. So, for example, Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen who we allegedly killed with a drone strike in Yemen. We haven't acknowledged that we killed him. President Obama held a press conference the day he was killed, and he came out and said Anwar al-Awlaki was killed, using the passive voice. I know the students here have been taught don't use the passive voice, but when you're the president, sometimes it's useful to use the passive voice because you don't have to take responsibility. But if we had not had the ability to push a button and kill Anwar al-Awlaki, I don't think the alternative would have been that we would have invaded Yemen and, you know, killed thousands of civilians in an attempt to capture him. I think the alternative would have been that we would have worked more closely with the Yemen government. We would have provided more resources so that they would have the ability to capture and neutralize him.
Okay. One clarification, Mary Ellen O'Connell holds the short chair in law at Notre Dame. That is not a height reference. That's named after Robert and Marion Short. Mary Ellen O'Connell.
Well, my very sincere congratulations to Susan Derwin and everyone here at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I don't think there is a more important issue that our nation is debating right now than targeted killing, and I'm very happy to be part of this important discussion. I've been working on this issue since November 2002, when the Los Angeles Times first broke the news that two Hellfire missiles had been shot into a vehicle driving on a road in Yemen, in an area where there was no armed conflict. The Hellfire missiles were fired from a drone operated by the CIA based on the African continent and the small French protectorate of Djibouti. There has never been as much interest, though, as there is now, and I really think we're coming to a turning point. Here we are in May 2013, 11 years after 12 and a half years from that first CIA targeted killing with drones. And the Bureau of Investigative Journalism reports that we're getting very close to killing almost 4,000 people through the method of drones firing missiles and dropping bombs outside areas of armed conflict. And amongst those 4,000 people, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates that 200 to 300 our children. I do very much hope that the new interest in this targeted killing policy of our government under two presidents is beginning to change. We've gotten so much more accurate information about what's really going on just in the last year or so We have had, of course, Senator Paul's filibuster, which was very helpful in raising public awareness, but also John Brennan's confirmation hearing brought out a great deal of detail. The United States is under two United Nations investigations into this practice. There are a series of lawsuits going on around the world. You heard about one from Susan Derwin, but there are several in the United Kingdom and other countries as well. I hope all of this bodes pressure and is indicative of a turning point and pressure from the American people moving away from the use of drones or targeted killing in general, use of military force outside of armed conflict zones to suppress terrorism. This is really important, I think, for three fundamental reasons. This killing is unlawful. It is counterproductive to the successful suppression of terrorist groups over time. And killing of this kind that meets neither our effectiveness nor our legal standards is in conflict with our most fundamental moral principles. I've only been given 5 minutes to make this statement, and I've probably used a good minute or so of that time already. So I need to focus on the area that's my area of particular expertise. I hope I didn't say, Avery, that people shouldn't talk about this law if they are not experts in it, but we've heard a lot of discussion about what the law is governing the use of drones, and I'm afraid a great deal of it has been inexpert, has been perhaps useful to political leaders who want to carry out these killings, but have not really been an accurate portrayal of what the law says. So let's talk about that in the few minutes that we have, because this is a nation under laws. We were founded to be under the rule of law and not under the rule of a human being, a man, a sovereign. And it is essential to maintaining our way of life, to being who we are as Americans, that we continue in this most awesome of all things that we do, killing another person, that we hew very closely, that we are in strict compliance with the rule of law. Well, the law that's relevant to what we're talking about today is international law. Officials of both the Bush and the Obama administration have acknowledged that it is international law, the law governing the resort to military force, which is relevant to this debate. Drones, you see, the generations of drones that we've been using, the Predator, the Reaper, and the new Avenger, fire Hellfire missiles and they drop 500-pound bombs. Those are military weapons. Those are not the weapons that we allow other kinds of authorities, such as police authorities, to use in non-armed conflict situations. So we are talking about the use of military force, and we're talking about the international law that governs that force because we are using this military force outside the United States on the sovereign territory of other nations. International law on resort to force is one of the oldest areas of this law. Avery mentioned the Just War Doctrine. Yes, its origins go back to the Just War Doctrine, but it is part of modern codified treaty law. It is fundamentally part of the United Nations Charter. The rules were written that we should be following in 1945 following the Second World War, but they were reconfirmed and consensus of all the world in 2005, that's 4 years after the 9/11 attacks, the world came together in New York after a thorough review of the United Nations Charter rules on the use of force, and in New York, in the World Summit, the rules of the UN Charter were reconfirmed. So what do these say, briefly and importantly? The rules begin, and this is so often forgotten in these discussions, in Chapter 1, with Article 2, Paragraph 4. That is the heart of the UN Charter. And that rule is a general prohibition on states resorting to military force in the pursuit of their foreign policies. It is a general prohibition on using force. There are only two express exceptions in the UN Charter. They're both in Chapter 7 of the Charter. The first one, in Article 39 and 41, says that the Security Council may authorize states to use military force when it is seeking to restore international peace and security. The other exception is in Article 51 of Chapter 7, and it says that a state may use military force in self-defense if it is the victim of an armed attack, and then until the Security Council acts. You heard the question about the Gulf War. Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. It used military force against, aggressive military force against Kuwait. Kuwait had the right to respond in self-defense, and it could even ask for collective self-defense, and really all of the world came to its defense, and it was liberated through that effort. Excellent example of Article 51 in action. That's it. Those are the two exceptions in the Charter. Now, there's one other basis in which states have said that they have a right to use military force. It's somewhat out of the Charter realm because it has to do with the consent of a state or the invitation of the leadership of a state to another country to come in on their territory when that government is facing a civil war. So today in Afghanistan, the U.S. forces and the other 42 countries that are using force are doing so on behalf of the government of Hamid Karzai. He has invited us into Afghanistan. Afghanistan today is the scene of a civil war, a counterinsurgency war. It is no longer the self-defense war that it was following 9/11. That ended when our friends became the rulers of Afghanistan in 2002. So that's an example where we are fighting at invitation with the consent of the government in effective control. But it has to be a civil war to be able to use military force. Otherwise, you're violating the human rights of people on that territory. In the absence of war, armed conflict of that intense nature among organized armed groups, you have to respect the human right to life of people on your territory, restrict your resort to lethal force to what we allow our police to do in normal peacetime situations. They can use lethal force to save a life immediately. Recall when, in Syria, Assad started using military force against the opposition protesters to his government. All the world said, this is excessive force. He is using military force against people who are not engaged in fighting and joining with him in an armed attack against him. So that would be excessive force if you're using military force when you should be using police-type measures to restore order, to counter crime. In addition to these bases for resorting to force, Security Council, self-defense, invitation, international law has additional rules about when it's lawful to resort to military force. And in particular, a state may only use that force, can only use force against a state, for example, in self-defense, when the state where it's attacking is responsible for the attack on the state. So Iraq against Kuwait or Afghanistan against the United States on 9/11. The defense has to be targeted against the state responsible. There's no such thing in international law as global wars on terror. Being able to use military force against an individual or small group somewhere else because there's fighting of a self-defensive kind on the territory of a state that has attacked you. That's simply not part of general international law. And then two more important rules. The force that you use has to be necessary to accomplish your defensive purpose or the purpose the Security Council has set out, or to stop the insurgency. And it has to be performed in such a way that the cost, the number of people you kill in your self-defense or Security Council authorized force, is not excessive. I'm just going to give you one more brief rule, which is from another set of rules, not on resort to force, but from the Geneva Convention.
And Mary Ellen, if we can wrap up in a minute.
This is my last point.
Okay.
Under the Geneva Conventions, under the jus in bello, the rules on how you conduct force, it has to be the regular members of your armed forces or a closely associated militia. The CIA has no right under international law to carry out lethal missions anywhere, let alone with the use of force. There'll be plenty of time, I hope, for additional questions, because the one thing that has been, many people have been criticizing President Obama for, is they're saying, he's got to be more transparent. You heard David say he needs to tell people what he's doing. Well, you heard what I just explained. This is very well-known public law. It is ancient law. It is well-established. We know the facts on the ground of all these countries where we are attacking with military force. There's nothing less secret than the dropping of a 500-pound bomb in a place. This is not a question of President Obama just telling us what's in the secret memos. We know plenty, and it's unlawful.
Stick around. I have one question for you. We are going to get into these broader issues, but there's one specific one. It literally showed up today in an interview on the Huffington Post with a Colonel Bill Tart, who from Nevada has actually, if I can use this phrase, piloted these drones. And this is a point he makes about the relative protection of civilians that we heard about earlier. This is his quote. I'd like you to respond to it. There's a short time of flight for the weapon, he means the missiles, 30 to 40 seconds. And if anything changes, a child walks into the picture, your guy goes into a house and you don't know who's in the house, then you no longer meet the rules of engagement. You have the ability, more importantly, you have the moral obligation to move the weapon. And because it's a laser beam rider, I can move the weapon. Our airmen are in the loop. They understand the rules of engagement, the nuances, the laws of armed conflict. This suggests that as opposed to the kind of dropping of cluster bombs on a place trying to find bad guys and killing lots of good guys, that according to this pilot, it's actually a much more respectful way of dealing with people. Your response?
We don't allow our police to drop bombs on people or fire missiles at people. Why is that? Because outside of armed conflict zones, there is no tolerance for collateral damage. No child can be killed. The pilots in Nevada have generally been, they're generally Air Force, and they are focused on Afghanistan. Within an armed conflict zone defined under international law, such as the one in Afghanistan, the drone can be a much better launch vehicle than high aerial fixed-wing bombardment. I agree with that. But everyone that we are attacking outside of the armed conflict zone, and the U.S. is only in one armed conflict zone today, only one place where armed conflict hostilities are going on, and that is Afghanistan. Using drones outside any of those other places, you say they're more precise, but we shouldn't be using drones to kill anyone outside those places.
All right. So, join us. Have a seat. Have a seat. Because we're now going to have this free. I was going to say contestants, like this is The Price is Right. What I promised the participants is that they would each have a chance to now engage in something that one of the others had said that they might like to put a gloss on or make a point on our own. So, who would like to begin? David,
I'd be happy to begin. I think, as is probably clear, I share a great deal of Mary Ellen's skepticism about the use of drones. But I think the question is a little more difficult and complicated and nuanced than Mary Ellen suggests. And so, just to take one example, the vast majority of the drone strikes that have been conducted have been in the border region of Pakistan. Why? Because that's where our enemy, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, retreated to by going through the mountains over the borders so that they could then arm themselves and continue the fight. They took the battle to Pakistan. We didn't take the battle to Pakistan. They took the battle to Pakistan. At that point, it seems to me a little wooden to insist that the battle is in Afghanistan, and as soon as an Al-Qaeda or Taliban military fighter crosses over the borderline in the mountains there, we can no longer shoot to kill. He can shoot to kill us. He will shoot to kill us, but we can't shoot to kill him. So I think it's actually more complicated than that. Another example is Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden wasn't on the battlefield, but I think the killing of Osama bin Laden was justified. He was the leader of the organization with which we were engaged in armed conflict. We took him out in a situation where the country in which he was living was unwilling and unable to turn him over. And in that situation, unless he surrendered, it's legitimate to kill, just as it would be legitimate to kill him were he holed up in a cave on this side of the border. So I think that that there are some very, very serious questions here. I'm not a supporter of our practices thus far, but I think that it's that there are lines to be drawn, and they're not just drawn at the Afghan-Pakistan border.
I know Mary Ellen is jumping to get in, but I can tell. But I want to bring Avery in, and I want to do this, and then
okay.
Just
as long as I can respond to some of these.
Yes, well, you will. I mean, we've got some time here.
Yep,
this isn't one of those 30-second and cable things. And I want to put it in a sharper way than David, because you mentioned the fact that there's a certain view that may not be represented here. So let me try. Wait a second. Al-Qaeda is a stateless group, no nation. They don't wear uniforms. They don't fight a war the way traditional wars are fought. But they, in effect, declared war on the United States. They blew up a couple of our embassies. They killed 3,000 people. And they've said, we think the right amount of Americans who should die to make up for all your depredations is 4 million. That's them. Under those circumstances, if they're hiding out in northwest Pakistan with perhaps the help of the inner services intelligence people, my feeling is, go get them. Your response?
Well, I happen to agree both that the Osama bin Laden killing was justified, and to some degree we should recognize that there is an armed conflict that is occurring with al-Qaeda. I think that actually most Americans also accept that point. But I think Mary Ellen also has a valid riposte rebuttal to that, to say that that kind of armed conflict, an armed conflict with a non-state actor that's occurring outside of your territory, it's not fully recognized within international law as it stands. It's the new expression is a transnational, non-international armed conflict. And to some degree, this is a new terminology that's being invented to address this kind of problem. So as I understand it, Mary Ellen's point, and she'll correct me, I'm certain, if I'm mistaken, is that international law does not recognize that you're permitted to do that, no matter how strongly you may feel about it. However, that, I think, speaks to the point that I raised at the end of my brief introduction, which is that we do have to revisit international law to recognize some of the changing circumstances, that this represents a new kind of threat that cannot be easily deterred, is very difficult to prevent. And so while I think that Mary Ellen has a point, I think that that is merely an opportunity and a challenge for us to find ways that we can permit limited use of instruments and weapons like drones against these kinds of dangers without allowing it to get out of control and become a global conflict without limit.
As you respond, if you can, fold in an answer to the question, if guys are out to kill as many Americans as they can and they're hunkered down in northwest Pakistan, what do we do about them?
There's plenty of international law that's very effective against terrorist organizations of that kind. The first and most important thing to do, which we have, for example, there's an excellent study from 2008 by the RAND Corporation that points out you do not effectively suppress terrorist groups through military force. They are best addressed through a combination of law enforcement methods and bringing people into the political process. This is where you have success. And this is the RAND Corporation, not known to be namby-pamby peaceniks, as perhaps I am. But this is now again and again. There's a new study from an excellent political scientist at Georgia Tech, showing that this kind of killing of that Avery was pointing to, the 30 leaders, this is really counterproductive. We now know that the way we've been approaching these groups we get this now from so many different sources. The number one recruiting tool for militant terrorist groups is the drone. It used to be Abu Ghraib, and now it is the drone. So why would we abandon our principles, our rule of law, do the lawless thing, do the violation of law, which I thought was what we were so against terrorism for in the beginning, when we have tools that are within the law that are shown to work effectively? Yes, we're going to have to go through a rebuilding period because we put ourselves in a very bad place after 12 years. And so there might be, you know, this is going to take certainly leadership to understand again what the law really is. This business that we've been hearing for so many years, well, these non-state actors, they don't respect borders. You have to kill them wherever they are. Sorry, but all of we human beings exist in some territorial space. All of our remarks have been about places, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia. These are real places. When you attack these non-state actors, you're attacking territory. There are other ways to do this. For example, remember when John Brennan came out of the Situation Room and told us that Osama bin Laden had been killed? He said our SEALs were under orders to either capture or, if he resisted arrest, to kill. Osama bin Laden, that most violent of all terrorists, did not have a bomb dropped on his compound. A Hellfire missile did not rip through his family and his neighbors' families. He was taken by ground troops using handheld weapons under, according to Mr. Brennan that night, correct rules under international law. You are allowed, if somebody resists arrest, to kill them. Now, if they're a known dangerous person of that kind, there is no tolerance in international law for police to kill bystanders. We all know that. And in fact, no one else, there were some people trying to stop the SEALs, so two others were killed. But compared to almost any drone strike, Osama bin Laden's family were treated according to the rules and as they should have been. The difference, so the most important, can I go ahead and tie this up? We were on the territory of Pakistan without their permission. And this is, under international law, a situation like that is, I think, defensible because we were allegedly using law enforcement rules. You can use lethal force of a lesser nature under the Article 2-4 threshold of the kind that police use or that our ships use in trying to arrest another ship, a small amount of force as a countermeasure, when a country like Pakistan is not doing what their obligation is under international law. They have plenty of international law obligations, Security Council resolutions, to attempt to arrest and extradite to the United States Osama bin Laden. They didn't do that. And so I think at that point the United States could send a SEAL team under police law enforcement type rules to attempt to make the arrest themselves.
Okay.
That's very different from dropping bombs on people. And in 2014, David's point about using military force in the border area, which is highly questionable anyway, but it should all come to an end, right? So let's get back to what works. Let's get back to what we supposedly did for Osama bin Laden. Follow the law on law enforcement.
Avery wants in.
Sure. Okay.
Avery, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just briefly preface this by agreeing with one of the main points that Mary Ellen made, which is that law enforcement is a great thing and it has to be part of the overall strategy that we're pursuing. And hopefully in the long run we can build up the international mechanisms, you know, the international police force, so that we can eventually use law enforcement measures in places like Northwest Pakistan, in the Fatah. But at the moment there's not much prospect of that. In fact, the Pakistani army is afraid to enter North Waziristan, I suspect, because they imagine that they're going to be defeated by the Taliban there, to their great embarrassment. And actually, that would really be bad, not just for them, but for the international community, because it would really discredit and destabilize the government. This is a nuclear weapon state. There's already a big threat. So maybe eventually that could be a solution, and it's great if it is. But in the short run, it's not. Now just let me get to the disagreement point. Mary Ellen also said that military force doesn't work against terrorist groups, and particularly this kind of targeted killing as a lethal use of force, doesn't effectively suppress groups. And I think that that's not true. I think that the principal example that you can look back to, the principal campaign that provides an exemplar of this, is the Israeli response to the Second Intifada,
where all these same complaints and criticisms were made of the Israeli use of targeted killing, which, by the way, they do reportedly sometimes use drones to do now. So there are actually cases in the world, David, of other countries using drones to go after terrorists, and we haven't objected to it, as you suggested that we would, or refused to tolerate it. In fact, we don't really say very much about it at all. But the at the time that the Israelis were using targeted killings against the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, everybody said, oh, well, this is just going to cause more violence. You're going to have much more recruitment for these groups. It's going to cause a cycle of violence. It's going to get worse and worse over time. But as part of a larger strategic package, which also involved increased defensive measures, like the wall, also controversial, but certainly probably helped to suppress the violence, the targeted killing campaign was successful in stopping the intense campaign of suicide bombing in Israeli cities. And I think that there are other examples where decapitation strategies have proved quite effective in suppressing terrorist violence. So I don't think there's a clear conclusion that this will not be effective or cannot be effective. Quite the opposite.
I would point out that the six leaders of Shin Bet in this rather remarkable documentary, Gatekeepers, come to a different conclusion.
Absolutely.
On this one, they're more Mary Ellen. They're saying these guys have run Shin Bet going back the last 30 or 40 years. That is the Israeli organization specifically devoted to trying to stop terrorism in the occupied territories. And they said basically it is a recruitment technique. But that doesn't mean that I want to just say, okay, that's the end of that, because I'd like to bring David into this and I will pose the question to you. You may not want to answer it with respect to what I'm saying, because I'm putting it, again, pretty bluntly, I think. And then I want Mary Ellen to respond and anybody else. The idea of bringing Al-Qaeda into the political process, that's the way we're going to stop these guys, strikes me, forgive me, as Ted Coppolois used to say, it strikes me as the height of naivete. Osama bin Laden declared war on the United States because we sent troops into the, quote, Holy Lands. We sent them into the Holy Lands as part of the effort to liberate Kuwait, a Muslim country attacked and invaded by a secular dictator. That's what ticked him off about us. Not drone strikes, not violence. That was his citation. He also said, the reason we're going to win this is because we love death and you love life. Now, it does seem to me, and I want to get David's response, then obviously yours, is at what point do we say about a group, stateless though they may be, hiding out in some country other than a defined enemy, say, you know what, you guys are out for our blood, and we're going to get you first?
Well, I think certainly in the wake of 9/11, it was appropriate to use military force to go in after Osama bin Laden, and we didn't have to, even though much of the world, including much of Europe, thinks we should have responded through law enforcement measures, they're better, war is counterproductive, et cetera. I don't think that was a realistic response. I think it was a legally available option. I think it was the only politically realistic option. I don't think you were going to convince Al-Qaeda's central supporters that they should, sit down and have tea with us. But I am not against the use of military force, in some absolute way, nor am I, as I suggested, against it when you cross a border. But I do think that I'll just stop there. I'm not taking the position that you're ascribing, the naive. Here's what I want to say in response. I don't think the issue is whether we can convince Osama bin Laden to sit down to tea with us. I think the issue is really how do we affect the range of people around the core. The core we may have to kill or capture, right? We may have to go to war against. But that won't solve the problem unless we can somehow peel away the concentric circles around that core. And if we engage in tactics like torture under President Bush, or in this case, like secret killing by remote control with buttons that are in a way that's not accountable to anybody, the risk is that we create incentives for people on the outside who might be wavering to support that core, to move into that core. Whereas if we are seen as responding in appropriate rule of law ways to lawless, horrific actions like terrorist attacks, then I think you reduce the incentives for those people who might be sympathetic to actually become supporters. And that, to me, is the way that you defeat terrorists, is by isolating them, not by getting them to have tea with you, but by isolating them from the potential supporters. And I think we've done a very bad job at that.
So let me put a different level of question to you about this, because part of the questions that were raised about this is the process by which the president and the CIA go about this. Seems to me to raise, whatever you think of the general policy, some pretty serious questions. Would it make a difference if somehow the process was, and I'm trying to imagine how this would happen, was more open? I mean, I can't imagine that we're going to have a public viewing of the president sitting down with the CIA and saying, okay, who's on the list this week and why? But if we knew why people were being targeted, would it make any difference? Or in your view, are you back to the core notion, look, this is a violation of international law, it's no good, I don't care what you do and how you do it, stop it?
Yes. There was a report by the UN Special Rapporteur for extrajudicial killing in January 2003, a very brave Pakistani woman lawyer named Asma Jahangir, and she said that November 2002 killing was an extrajudicial killing. That resolved it. She didn't need to know any more about the secret. She knew the facts on the ground. She knew what had happened, and she reported. The next UN Special Rapporteur to give a report in 2010 was Philip Alston from NYU, and he was the one who began this business. If we can just have the Americans tell us what their parameters are and how they're doing this decision-making, how you get on the kill list. And I know him well. He's a great champion of human rights. All I can think of is that, in his mind, if the American people knew that, in fact, this was quite a bankrupt policy, that you cannot square this with fundamental principles, such as the most fundamental principle of all, the right to life, the American public would stand up and say, stop. And that the president was not going to be able to resist these calls for transparency. That's the only reason I can think of why Philip, in my view, didn't stand by Asma Jahangir and say this is unlawful. So, no, we know plenty. Finding out that the president spends, you know, and we I don't know what else there is that could even possibly be secret. We know all about the little deck of cards and the president spending all of his time. Mark Mazzetti says that our colleague Harold Koh, the legal advisor at the State Department until recently, he goes through all the little details. I didn't know that he should be doing that, but we know the facts on the ground. That's what's important, and okay, we are violating fundamental law.
There was some serious head shaking going on to your right. So I have to inquire, yeah, assuming this isn't a seizure, what's up?
Well, I think there's actually quite a bit that we don't know. We don't know, for example, what standard of proof they employ in deciding whether to put someone on the kill list. Is it proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what we require before we can impose the death penalty or indeed a day in prison? Is it probable cause, which is what we require for a search warrant? We have no idea because they haven't told us. We don't know whether there is somebody within the administration who plays the role of devil's advocate, who basically argues for life. Right? You're not, in most instances, it's not realistic to say, well, here's a person who we consider the enemy in an ongoing armed conflict, and we're going to, you know, let him come in here and defend himself and see all our intelligence against him and respond. That's not realistic. But I think it is perfectly plausible to assign that role institutionally to an actor within the administration in that proceeding. As far as we know, there is no such.
You mean like almost like a public defender, but not public?
Yeah, yeah. I mean that would be an improvement over
a
what we.
A secret defender.
That would be an improvement over what we have.
The
absolutely. We don't know.
It's called the Star Chamber.
And I guess I think the reason that we need to know more. I mean, one reason is the reason I began with. Transparency is absolutely essential to the rule of law and to accountability. And as long as we don't have that, even if they're following the most rules that would even satisfy Mary Ellen, right? If it's secret, that's not satisfactory, right? And I honestly don't know the rules that they. I mean, I've read everything that they've said. I don't know the rules that they're. Following. I don't know the substantive criteria they're using. I don't know how they define a signature strike. I don't know how they count civilians. You know, there's just a tremendous amount I don't know. But where I differ from Mary Ellen is I don't think you can say it's illegal, we know enough, end of story. I think there are two contexts in which it is legal to use lethal force against a human being without a trial. And that's in an ongoing armed conflict where that person is a member of the enemy force fighting against you, and you don't have to do capture or kill. You can kill. Now, if they surrender, that's one thing, but you don't have to wait to see if they surrender. You can kill without going in and asking them, do you want to surrender? That's long been the rule in wartime. And so to the extent that targeted killing fits that formula, it doesn't seem to me to be illegal. And secondly, self-defense. To the extent that someone actually poses an imminent threat of armed attack upon the United States, it's within our authority to respond with lethal force if it's necessary, if it's a last resort. And I think it would be irresponsible for a president not to do that. They say those are the two grounds upon which they assert they use this force. Now, when I look at the facts, I don't feel like they all fit that, but I don't know all the facts, and Mary Ellen doesn't know all the facts, and none of us know all the facts, and that, to me, is at bottom what is most unacceptable. We should know the facts about what the policies are that drive, authorize our president to kill people in this way.
Avery wants in, I know Mary Ellen wants in, and then it's your turn. There are microphones at the front. If you have a question, we invite you to ask them. And I should tell you that we will wrap up with very brief closing statements of 2 minutes, I hope, from each. But Avery, to the point.
Yeah, I actually wanted to just jump on what David is saying and say, you know, I think that there's a number of issues that need clarification. And the standard for imminence, for example, what's the standards being used in any individual case, or what actually qualifies somebody as a combatant or a civilian participating in hostilities? How closely are they adhering to the existing law? I mean, what's the rationale for geography? If one al-Qaeda operative goes to a new country, does that make them a legitimate target, or do you need a whole base before you move into targeting in Yemen or Somalia? What is the underlying rationale? I did an interview with Philip Alston, the UN rapporteur that Mary Ellen was talking about, and discussed some of these issues with her, and it actually goes to the point that she was raising. The reason that he didn't condemn the attacks broadly, or at least the reason that he gave me, was that he thought that some of them may be legal under exactly the standards that David's mentioning, that some may be legitimate cases of self-defense, and some may be, there may be cases where the non-international armed conflict legitimately crosses a border, let's say into the Fatah area of Pakistan. So what he wanted was clarification on what the legal rationale of the government was, and I think that's exactly what we haven't provided effectively and what we should provide, and that may do something to diminish recruitment. And by the way, on the point about recruitment with the Israeli campaign, I don't doubt that sometimes targeted killing can be a tool of recruitment. I think it was in the Israeli case, and it is today probably in the Yemen case. Gregory Johnson has made the case that Pakistan and Yemen has expanded, and it may be associated with the use of drone strikes there. The argument for the drone strikes isn't that it diminishes the size of the group, but its capabilities. by eliminating the leaders and the experts and the bomb makers. Daniel Beinman did a study, particularly in the Israeli case, showing that the effectiveness of attacks diminished rapidly over time, and the defense forces, this is part of a larger strategy in which you also improve your defense and improve your legal rationale, they were able to then stop the attacks and prevent the ongoing suicide bombings from continuing. So that's the strategy, I think, that's being pursued, and that we need to do not just that, but also make a powerful case. I think there is a strong case to be made that these are efficient attacks, that they can diminish the capabilities of these organizations, and they can be consistent with the law. But the administration still has yet to really convincingly make that case. I think they made a beginning with speeches by Brennan and Coe and Jay Johnson. But they need to get, I think, along with David, they have to get down into the details and explain exactly how this does comply with the law, in their view.
All right. If you've got a question, start coming down. If you don't, that's fine. Not compulsion. I know, Mary Ellen, you want to make a comment here.
There's so much to say, and we really need to get our questions from the audience, but David's comment about the law of self-defense is simply incorrect. Under international law, in Article 51 of the UN Charter, there is no right to send a missile strike against an individual suspected of terrorism and perhaps a threat in the future. This is a right of states to defend themselves against other sovereign states that are responsible for an actual armed attack on a state. So this is what he suggested and what President Bush and President Obama tried to shoehorn into the law of self-defense simply doesn't fit. And here's the proof. There is only one country that may possibly support what the U.S. is doing, and that's Israel. The other 191 countries in the world do not agree with the way David just characterized the law of self-defense.
And on that theory, if we had identified the 9/11 attackers on their way, and the only way to stop them was to kill them, we couldn't use force to kill them,
David,
because they're not a state.
We
can only respond
to a state.
Why do
you think we had the right to go into Afghanistan? Because we found Afghanistan, and the British did the white paper, that Afghanistan was responsible for having aided. Because al-Qaeda could not have carried out 9/11 if they didn't have the support of Afghanistan.
I agree with you that was lawful.
Excuse me, Mary Ellen, I've got to turn to the audience. I've got to. Because we promised them.
Yeah.
We promised them. I know it's frustrating, but you know, classes go 50 minutes. We got less time here. Start here. And questions, if you got it to an individual, that's fine. If you raise them, that's fine. As concise as you can do it. Go ahead.
So I'm an undergrad here. I'm not a military technology expert, but we've been talking a lot about international law, transparency of policy. But I'm just wondering, do you think the conversation would be different if it were, if the weapon were like a piloted plane, an F-15, or instead of a drone, you know?
Does drones make the conversation different?
Yeah.
You know, I think it does for the reasons I articulated at the outset. I think it makes it reduces the disincentives to use military force, thereby making the temptation to use military force when other means might respond to the problem effectively very strong. And that's, I think, very disturbing. If we're going to try to solve our problems moving forward by pushing buttons and killing human beings around the world, that's not a world I'd like to live in.
According to this new book, Day of the Knife, before 9/11, when bin Laden was targeted by Clinton, the CIA's position was you could not kill him with a bullet, but you could kill him with a cruise missile. Now, you know, it takes lawyers to figure that one out. So I'm going to move on. I'm going to make an insulting, cheap remark and move on because that's what I do.
Or the CIA not to understand
that's what
the
I do.
Law requires.
Go ahead.
Hello. My question is, do we know of other countries using armed drones to the same extent that we're using them? And if other countries start heavily using them, what kind of consequences do you anticipate? Basically, what happens when other leaders can push a button and kill someone on American soil?
Good question.
Every military in the world is going to have armed drones before long. There are over 50 countries that have them now. So far, the only two countries that have used armed drones have been the United States and Israel.
According to a story that was recently reported, China also believes it has an armed drone.
And a stealth drone.
And considered using it against a drug smuggler who they couldn't otherwise get, but they decided against it at the last minute. And Iran also has a combat drone, but not one that fires missiles. It's called the Ambassador of Death, and it flies into things and explodes.
And I would just add that this is one of the reasons why it's so important that we use these tools in a way that is transparent and defensible around the world, because it is not that far in the distant future that other countries are going to be engaging in this kind of tactic, and they will point to the United States as a justification for the kinds of attacks that they want to engage in, and we won't be happy with it.
Okay.
Thank you.
We've asked each of these participants for 2 minutes for a final thought. Let me go the other way. Let me start with... Actually, yes. Let's go David, Mary Ellen, Avery.
Sure. I guess I would just close by underscoring why I think it matters that we get this question right. And I do think it's a question. I think there are very, very serious questions that remain unresolved, but it's absolutely critical that we resolve them, and we resolve them in a way that we can live with. One is because, as I suggested earlier, what we do today will be cited as a precedent by other countries tomorrow. President Obama was said to be very concerned about the possibility that he might lose the election and President Romney might become the president. And so in the waning days of his administration, there were orders to come up with clear rules for the targeted killing program, because they were concerned Romney would be doing the targeted killing, not Obama. But then when Obama won, apparently the pressure to come up with those clear rules waned, and we don't have them. We need clear rules, whether it's Obama or Romney or Jesus Christ, who is engaging in this activity. That's number one. Number two, it is critical that we do it in a fair and just way, because otherwise there is the risk, very real risk, that our practice will serve as a recruitment tool to gather support for that core that is still fighting against us. Number three, transparency is important because it is critical to the whole notion of checked government power. If we live in a democracy and a government of limited power, but if we live in a country where the president can kill any one of us pursuant to a secret policy in an unacknowledged killing, then we no longer live in a government of limited powers. And then number four, I think it's an ethical and moral issue. The power to take another person's life is not absolutely prohibited. It happens all the time, as unfortunate as it is, but it must be consistent with the rule of law. And if it's not transparent, it isn't consistent with the rule of law.
We do have the clear rules that we need at this point in our history. I'm sure that bank robbers would really like the rules against robbing banks to be changed, but that is not what is required. What is required is for this country, which was built on the rule of law, to get back into compliance with the rule of law. President Obama, when he campaigned in 2008, said there was no such thing as a global war on terror. And yet he found it politically expedient when he became president to concoct the exact same thing and to continue killing people under the same rubric. He just changed the name. A worldwide armed conflict against al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces. Ladies and gentlemen, it is the same thing and it needs to end. There is only one other argument once we take this global war concoction off the table, and that's the one David referred to as self-defense. He has misstated what international law and what the whole world knows the law under the UN Charter to be in self-defense. If another state is responsible for a significant attack on a country, then you may react in self-defense, as Kuwait did, as we did against Afghanistan after 9/11. But to bring all the world into this kind of danger, to say that the rules are not clear, frankly, is not worthy of this great nation.
Avery.
I think that we're making some small progress in the right direction. For example, President Obama's decision to shift the focus of the drone campaign from the CIA, which I think Mary Ellen rightly criticized, to the military is a step in the right direction. But if I think that we want our campaign against al-Qaeda to work, the drones have to be part of a much broader strategy, which involves explaining what the legal rationale for our action is and reinforcing our identity as a country of laws. And that includes disentangling the various legal rationales that the government is kind of confusingly referred to, self-defense, or is this because it's a non-international armed conflict. I think they have to be specific about what they think applies to each individual case, and to make their case, to tell the right story to the people here and around the world. I think there is a strong story to be made about how these instruments can be useful going forward if, finally, they're subject to a reasonable set of rules and restraints that prevent them from being abused, and reasonable oversight as well. And I think what's most crucial for that is that there's a willingness to compromise on the part of the defenders and the critics of drones on a new set of rules that are going to govern their use going forward. Drones aggravate a deep-seated fissure in international law between what Americans think self-defense consists in and what much of the rest of the world thinks it consists in. From Mary Ellen's perspective, I think not only is our current president a war criminal because of the campaign that he's conducting, our former president, President Bush, also was a war criminal, and that's true of many critics, and actually President Clinton as well because of the Operation Infinite Force, where he used cruise missiles to produce much the same effect. On the other hand, the international community and the international legal system is going to be badly damaged if America defects from it to pursue these kinds of policies. So there's an interest on both sides, critics and defenders, the international legal system and the American political system, to find a reasonable compromise to restrain and direct these powerful instruments in a more useful fashion and to explain it better to the American people and to the world. And I think that's what we need to do.
First, I want to compliment not just our participants, but the questioners for asking questions. Thank you. I will just leave you with a 20-second kind of curiosity on my part, I guess, that we're arguing and talking and trying to figure out in the most exquisite way what are the limits of force against individuals in a stateless situation. And yet, when a war is declared, the killing of thousands upon thousands of civilians, completely innocent people, is part of the system. Whether it's in Dresden or Tokyo or Poland or the strafing of civilians in Spain, all bets are off. And it's one of those curious things about where we are now that this particular kind of argument is taking place, I would suggest, because the nature of conflict has undergone a rather dramatic change. And we're going to be wrestling with this one, I think, for a long time to come. And it's why I'm really gratified that so many of you came out on a beautiful evening to listen to a very intense conversation about a very intense and important matter. Thank you all for coming, and thank you guys very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.